Ben Yagoda is he's a great guy, and he knows all about writing, and he teaches it there at Delaware, you know. He went to Yale, and he's written a lot of books. He knows everything, and he wrote this one, for example, How to Not Write Bad. What's wrong with that? Anyone? He's on the line with us now from Swarthmore, and hey, Ben, how are you this morning?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk. Well, let's see. You know, that's preemptive.
Don't be presumptuous. Huh? Okay.
I only talked really to one. I talked to Kurt Vonnegut one time about writing.
Mm.
And he said, don't never use a semicolon.
Semicolon, yes. I've seen that quote attributed to him.
Yes. Well, he said it right here among other places, I'm sure. He said, all it proves is that you went to college. That's what he said.
Well, you know, I have a line, I think, something to the effect that when you have the urge to use a semicolon, lie down until it goes away.
Yeah.
Not lay down, but lie down.
Well, can we settle this once and for all? Is it ever proper to use a semicolon? In what situation, like defensively, could you use one if someone came at you with a colon?
Defensively?
Yes.
I'm not sure how exactly that would work. Sometimes it's offensive.
Yeah.
But sure, it absolutely is. And I bet if you studied, and there's probably a PhD student doing that right now, and if not, here's an idea. Study the works of Vonnegut to find all the semicolon uses, and I bet you'll find quite a few.
Yeah.
It is okay. I mean, the basic rule is two situations. Number one, when you have a list of things that would otherwise be separated by commas,
okay.
But within that list, there is punctuation. In that case, you separate it with a semicolon.
So if there's a bunch of commas in your list, right?
Right.
Then you use
the
a semicolon.
The cities he visited were Boise. What state is Boise? In Idaho. Boise, Idaho. Boise, comma, Idaho, semicolon. Schenectady, comma, New York, semicolon.
Oh,
and
that way.
Such and such.
That's rather clumsy, though, isn't it?
It is a bit clumsy.
Yeah.
Correct, but clumsy, yeah.
It's correct, but is it advisable? Ben.
Well, if you,
would you
want to give
it?
The list of the cities he visited,
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm opposed to it, just on principle.
Duly noted. and the second time is when you have a sentence that consists of two complete clauses. Could be sentences on their own. I was there. Semicolon, she wasn't.
I was there, she wasn't.
That's okay.
Okay, yeah, no, that makes sense. I'll go with that. And it's so true in my life. Anyway, there's a lot of truth to it, so it deserves a semicolon.
Sorry to hear that,
Yeah, well, it's all right, it happens. Yeah. Let me ask you this now, Ben. Nobody writes anymore, they blog, right? I mean, people who might have written before and people who should never have written in the first place are now bloggers, right?
That's pretty deep. I mean, how do you differentiate writing and blogging?
Blogging has no rules to it and nothing to say.
Okay.
Nothing being said in bad form with no, you know, it shouldn't be there.
It's just a no reason for its existence kind of deal.
Well, it's very democratic now. I mean, everybody can blog. Everyone can
blog
and, you know, I blog and it's terrible.
I'm not sure if I'd agree with that. I haven't read your blog, but I would be highly suspicious if it's terrible. Or
it's all been said.
What?
It's all been blogged before.
It's been blogged.
They should call it flogging. That's how bad it is.
Flog through the blog. Well, the big difference is the concept of gatekeepers. You know, previously, 20, 30, whatever years ago, to have anything published, you know, anybody could write in their diary, Dear Diary or whatever, but to have it published and read by others, it would have to go through these gatekeepers, the editor of the New York Times, the editor of the New Yorker, the editor at Random House, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And as you say, that is just not the case. You can set up an account at Blogger or WordPress, and boom, you are out there and you've published yourself for the world to see.
That's right. You never see a job for a blogger editor.
That's right. Blogger editor
wanted.
No. And you know, that's there's the good and the bad to that. It was extremely undemocratic before. Not that that's necessarily only a bad thing, but these gatekeepers were the rulers of the universe, and they weren't the greatest godlike people ever. And their word ruled. so there's some not so great stuff with that. But nowadays, the good thing is that, you know, I submit more people are writing, and it's in the form of blogs and product comments on Amazon.com and texting and all these other forms, but they are out there writing, which is kind of cool.
Not really, no.
And some of it...
Well, look at what they're saying, though. Come on, Ben.
What's that?
Look at what they're saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's
trash.
Look at people.
Half of it is trash. Two-thirds.
Some are smart and some are not so smart.
I know.
And
so where's the benefit in that?
Where is the benefit? I don't know. There's some good stuff being written out there, and especially in some of these special interest kind of blogs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you're really into video games,
true,
which I'm not,
no,
you'll find websites and blogs that some of them actually are edited and have gatekeepers of one sort or another, and it's really informed, funny, knowledgeable, good writing, in my opinion. The problem is that if you don't know about video games, it's totally lost to you. So the kind of general interest stuff is falling by the wayside a bit.
Yeah. So it's kind of a narrow casting sort of thing. I can see that. But now Twitter, for example, I'm addicted to Twitter now, and it's actually ruined my life. I cannot write a complete sentence anymore with a subject and a verb and an object and a period after it. You know,
using capital
letters in the right. I mean, if you have 140 characters, I only need personally about 17 to 20 characters.
That's it. Yeah, we should have a new service instead of Twitter. It'll be Twit. It's even shorter than Twitter.
Thank you very much, Ben, for that endorsement.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that as an endorsement on my site from now on. Should be Twit. Ben Yagoda.
I tweet from at B. Yagoda, and I think I'm the only person on Twitter who only writes in complete sentences with subjects and verbs. So I'm going a little bit against the grain there.
You do? Do you use capital letters?
Capital. Everything is proper. I can get maybe one sentence in there per tweet, but it's a real sentence. So I.
Well, don't you get people really trashing you for using capital letters? I mean, I did that
no.
when I started. You know. Like for
Never.
Names, I'd put the capital, you know, M and Michael or something. And people trashed me. Bad etiquette or something.
Your followers are a little judgmental, it sounds like.
Yes. They do have torches, a lot of my followers. That's a little upsetting.
The one time I've been admonished for anything I've done, that comes to mind on the social media stuff is my 22-year-old daughter, Maria. she texts, and people of that age, you know, text and younger, and I'm older than that. But it's a useful form of communication. When are you going to get there? I'll meet you at the bus, and so on. And at one time, after this had been going on for a while, she said, "Dad, don't put a period after a sentence when you're texting. It makes you look sarcastic." Like, what do you mean? She said, "Well, I'll see you at 3 p.m. And you texted back, good, period." It sounded like you were just meant the opposite.
Yeah, being ironic or something.
Being ironic, exactly. Yeah, good. Yeah, sure, good.
Yeah.
And
it's like air quotes or something.
So it's like either nothing or an exclamation point, or if you're really enthusiastic, two exclamation points.
Yeah, I got a 22-year-old daughter, too. And
yeah.
How old is your other one?
My other daughter is 24.
Oh, she's old, okay.
So she does texting as well.
Yeah. You know, people really don't write anymore. They message, though. Doesn't it affect writing in general when people only message to write? You know what I mean?
Well,
they're all messages.
You would think so, but you know, I teach writing at University of Delaware, and I've done so for a lot of years, 20 years, and that's actually one thing that I've never seen.
Really?
You know, you would think that people of that age would incorporate some of the tendencies of texting, like multiple exclamation points and LOL type abbreviations.
Yeah, so OMG has never turned up in anything they've turned in? Never?
Not once.
Wow.
It's actually the opposite problem. They're used to that kind of informal stuff, and then when it comes to a formal writing for publication, they get nervous, and they get a little spooked, and they go too far the other way, so use big words that are... unnecessarily big, or worst of all, don't mean what they think it should mean.
Yeah.
So It's if there's a meeting of the minds between the texting messaging on one hand and this overly formal stuff, that would be the golden way to the goodness in writing.
Well, that sounded like a complete sentence.
Hmm.
You know what, though? Do you think great literature will ever be written on a phone?
You know, I read a long New Yorker article about that's a thing now in Japan.
Or, yeah, I read that too.
Or at least was, that people write cell phone novels. And no, I frankly, that I can't get my mind around that.
Okay.
Can you?
No.
No, I wouldn't think so, no.
No. No. Well, I couldn't do it on a typewriter either. Or anyway. Okay, blogging, we talked about Twitters and so forth. Here's another thing now. My younger daughter, she's 19 now, wants to be a writer. And, okay, I'm not talking about her anymore, but I'm saying, what about the type of person, a young person now, who wants to write? They're sort of naturally verbal and can put that on paper and so forth, but they don't read.
Right. Oh, boy, that...
Does that happen in your classes?
You find? Does it ever...
Yeah.
Three exclamation points!
yeah,
yeah. It is ironic, and I remember they used to say that there are more people who wanted to be poets than people who actually bought books of poetry.
Oh, sure.
It was a weird disconnect, and I do feel that's more generally true now of writers. And the bad thing is, and again, I'm thinking you probably will agree that the single best way to develop your skills as a writer, become a good writer, is to read a lot of all different kinds of things, books, articles, blog posts, you name it, short stories, fiction, nonfiction. You pick up so much information, you pick up so much about the way to write, tone, style, the sound, rhythm, you pick up vocabulary, you pick up ideas about punctuation much better than by learning it in a grammar classroom. And that's the single biggest issue or problem I see with my students. I feel they're bright and they're motivated and they, you know, have some ability, but they just haven't read enough. So there's like huge amounts of stuff they don't know, and punctuation and spelling are big problems. No question about it.
Yeah, I keep leaving shopping bags filled with a good, a number of, a little Kafka here, a little, Joyce Carol Oates, whatever.
A little bit of a downer, Michael. I mean,
well, that's not all that's in there. There's some positive stuff too. Sylvia Plath is in there. There's a lot of
a little Vonnegut, maybe.
I mean, you're right. It is kind of negative now that I think about it. But that's just the things that I always thought were cool. Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, anything like that. And I'm not saying this is my daughter. Now I'm talking about. I'm saying if one had a daughter like that,
the hypothetical daughter.
Instead of watching The Housewives of wherever, why don't you just read a book and
You're doing the right thing because I think keep leaving those shopping bags and go walk away and then see the hypothetical person will kind of go through them and find the one thing, and that'll lead to other things. So I'm an optimist. I think that's going to happen.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a writer, but when I was a kid, I really liked humorous stuff. So I read everybody who wrote any Ring Lardner, and Thurber, obviously, and all. And so I could copy their styles, but it didn't work for me as well, as it did for them. But I read everyone. Walt Kelly, I used to read. I read all the collected Pogo strips. Because I thought it was so amusing to see Mark Twain. I read all of Mark Twain because that's all we had at home was a collection of Mark Twain. And so I started writing in dialect.
You have to have one thing. That's the best.
Started writing in dialect. That was a problem,
Dialect is not something that really works too well nowadays. Yeah. That's a little bit hard.
But why, why wouldn't you, if you wanted to be a writer, why wouldn't you see how it's done, at least?
You're absolutely right. It makes sense. But, on the one hand, you were lucky. You were lucky that you loved reading it. And it, John Updike talks about reading Woodhouse, and Dave Barry talks about reading Benchley. And I think that... I think we might have hit on something—the humor thing.
Yeah.
Updike didn't end up being a humorous writer, although he was witty. But Dave Barry did. But I think that's the way in: finding that thing that you like, that if not love, and that'll lead to other things.
I think Updike's pretty funny, though.
Yep, he can be.
He's
not
very
a laugh
funny.
A minute kind of,
all his waspy couples. What was that couple that he had for all his years?
The Marples.
Them.
you know, a little grim, but
yeah,
I could sense you like the darker side as well.
I like it, but plus I like the insights into wasp life, you know, that he provided. I really wanted to be one, you know, kind of.
It's a bit of a foreign country. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the New England, you know, and
travelogue.
It was cool, and I like that sort of thing.
Yeah, he's great. He's one of my all-time idols as a writer.
Yeah. Which, you know, when I lost Updike, you know, it's a problem for me now because I would find writers, and if I liked them, I'd read everything they wrote, even the bad stuff and the criticism and stuff, you know, everything that they wrote, read all. But when they start to die, then there's not going to be any more, you know.
No.
So I have all these dead writers now, and there's nothing coming from them.
Yeah. Well, except like writers like Louis L'Amour.
Yeah.
Who's one of the few times he's been mentioned in the same conversation as Updike, but but he died, and then they keep being new Louis L'Amour novels.
Oh, are there? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a brand, but yeah, it's not the same thing. You're absolutely right. I think we're kindred Updike spirits here. I was so into him once that I was really excited. I was in college that his one play was about to be published, Buchanan Dying.
Oh.
A play about the death of President Buchanan.
Well, that's a good one.
It didn't play on Broadway. But I remember kind of looking at the library catalog when it was going to come in, and actually being excited when it did. So pretty pathetic.
I'm not saying he didn't make mistakes. He made that Martin Van Buren one. You know, give me a break. What?
The sequel.
Oh, unbelievable. And then Philip Roth. It's, you know, I was surprised when the Pope quit.
Right.
But when Philip Roth quit, I mean, I didn't think that was even possible, or you could stop being a writer.
Well,
I was shocked.
In retrospect, with Roth, who's, I guess, about the same age as Updike, and now in his early 80s, he would write books regularly, one a year, one every other year, but they would get shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like 300-page end to 225, 150. And you could, you know, in retrospect, you could see there was a trend there.
Yeah.
And,
but the shorter is not bad.
No. But he was getting, I don't know if gnomic is the word, I'm not sure, but more brief until finally, you know, did Hamlet say the brevity is all, or somebody said that?
Somebody said it, yeah.
And that's the deal.
Yeah, that last one on the playground with the polio thing, the guys were spitting on the playground to try to give these other kids in New Jersey polio or something.
That was one of his second to last, third to last ones.
Yeah. It was short. It was mercifully short, I thought.
Right.
But it was kind of good still in the same way.
He's a good writer.
But what do you do now? It's like when the Beatles, you know, broke up. Philip Roth is gone. I got nobody left now.
Right. Well, you got to start looking for some of the younger folks, and you know, the
who would you
like
recommend?
Futures market.
Who would you recommend that I should?
Well, you know,
given my
the name that comes to mind is David Foster Wallace. Yeah. Ironically, he died.
He's
as well.
Dead too. Yeah. No. And I even interviewed him one time, and I said, "Don't you throw anything away?" That was the only thing I said, because all those footnotes and stuff, you know.
Right.
He said, "I throw a lot away," and that was the end of that conversation.
This is the best. The footnotes are the best. Yeah. You know,
he said they're endnotes, not footnotes.
Oh, so he corrected you on that point.
Yeah.
Well, he was the master of the footnote.
Yeah.
There's so many outstanding writers. I mean, I just read. I'm sort of gotten a bit more into nonfiction in my own reading, but. This, speaking of long books, a book called Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon, which is kind of about the nature of families in the United States today, and he worked on it for 10 years, and it's an awesome book. I mean, it's so beautifully written and reported, and, you know, excellent books come out all the time. For light reading now, I'm reading Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. It's a good thriller. So,
slower. I'm writing these down.
I don't think the blogosphere world and that change is having a especially deleterious effect on the better writers who still write books, articles, and so forth. I don't know. Yeah. Again, I'm an optimist. So,
and for people who are writing and beginning writers, or even along the way, I recommend your book. By the way, the Sound on the Page.
Thank you.
Style and voice and writing, because that is really sort of getting back to, you know, where this all comes from, the whole thing about being a reader first and having, you know, because that's very helpful, actually, thinking about why am I writing in the first place.
Well, I appreciate that. That was a book I did a few years ago, and it was about the notion of a voice, meaning a distinctive style. So if you read Joyce Carol Oates, or Philip Roth, or John Updike, David Foster Wallace, Hemingway, whoever, if you haven't read it before, but if you're familiar with that writer, and irrespective of the subject matter, if you read a few sentences, you know who it is. So I was trying to figure out, where does that come from? What was the spring of that personal voice? Just the way if you hear Charlie Parker or Art Tatum, or you know who it is.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, and it's been written about, but it's a bit mysterious. So I decided to try to talk to as many of these writers as I could. And Updike didn't do personal interviews, but he corresponded with me by letter, writing on his IBM Selectric typewriter, which was really cool. And I talked to Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer about style, and Cynthia Ozick, and Nicholson Baker, another great writer, Susan Orlean, just you know, over 40 writers about their thoughts on the subject. So that was really fun to do.
I like Ozick's. She's the one who hated Hemingway. Hates.
That's right.
And everything that resulted from him, because Hemingway wrote the short sentences. Like, he was like a prize fighter in the writing ring. Short sentences. Well, short sentences, I guess.
Short sentences.
More like a reporter might do.
And you know, the example I gave about the semicolon, I was there, she wasn't, I believe was it, to quote myself. So normally you might separate those two with a semicolon. Hemingway would be with a period.
Right.
And there's the sound of Hemingway right there. Same word, same meaning, but a different sound.
And apparently a lot of people adopted that style.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's what bothered her.
If you were a guy in kind of mid-century U.S., a male writer, that was who you had to contend with.
Yeah.
And some people did cool things with it, like in the detective genre, people like Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and Hammett were sort of doing a modified Hemingway. I would say even Vonnegut, to bring him back in, was in some way of the school of Hemingway and made it his own, which is what the best writers do.
Well, Vonnegut said he wrote for sophomores in high school or something, because he worked on a school paper.
Yeah, so that simplicity. Was
his, yeah.
He always talked about simplicity, clarity.
Yeah. And asked what his motive was in writing. He told me to feed his blank family. So you got to admire that sort of dedication.
I take it he didn't say blank.
No, he didn't say blank.
No.
But I did.
Okay.
All right, very good. Well, Ben, I know you probably have things to do. You got a big weekend planned?
Come up with something, sure.
Yeah, you got it. And actually, we didn't talk about this book. Did you want to talk more about this? But we can, about writing right and wrong. Thanks.
How to not write bad.
Yeah, how to not write bad. And what's wrong with that sentence, Ben?
Well, wrong is a harsh word. It splits an infinitive. You know, and you were probably taught not to do that, and that is a bogus rule. There is no such rule.
Not anymore, or there was?
No, there never was. It got invented. It was invented by some guys in the 1800s who thought that English should be modeled on Latin. Mm-hmm. And that was their notion.
Oh, okay.
And it had legs. And but there's nothing. People, Shakespeare and Henry James and everybody have split infinitives. So,
yeah.
But it still has held so strongly that about 40% of the time when people mention the name of my book, they call it How Not to Write Bad. They actually edit the title of the book.
So it's had some effect, a positive effect.
They just can't say How to Not Write Bad. And, of course, the other thing that is wrong, certainly for any kind of formal published writing, is to say bad instead of badly.
Badly.
Because it should be an adverb, not an adjective. But I was being playful there.
Would you say that adverb misuse is the number one crime committed by writers?
No, it's way down the list. Maybe bottom of the top 10, but there's worse crimes than that.
What would you, on your list, what would be the number one, because you got to read all this stuff.
Yeah.
Number one worst.
Wrong word. Wrong word.
Wrong word. Okay.
Sometimes spell check issues. So things like, stemming from the lack of reading, I had a student submit something that said, I wore a sequence-covered dress. And spell check was
they went with it.
That.
Yeah.
And someone else wrote about a heroin, H-E-R-O-I-N-E.
Oh, that's going to happen.
A heroin addict, A-T-T-I-C.
Liked bodice rippers a lot.
A colleague of mine had a student who wrote about someone's pompous boyfriend, P-A-M-P-A-S.
An Argentine.
Yeah, clearly, So, that's fun, but it's a little also unsettling that there are a lot of this. And then and things like, it's apostrophe S instead of S and your, things like that. And sometimes the online thesaurus is a problem because people... They already used, say, excellent, the last sentence, and they want to come up with an alternative, and they just click on the thesaurus, and they feel that all the words are equivalent, so they can just kind of close their eyes and pick one at random.
You know, I got a thesaurus for my bar mitzvah, and I seriously overused it. I turned in some sixth grade themes that were astounding in their use of vocabulary.
Yeah, you could tell,
Because it was Roget, too, because this is like we're talking about early 20th century or something, probably late 19th century, a lot of those terms that you don't hear anymore.
Right. You had the archaic-sounding sixth-grade theme.
That was good that way. Yeah, the spell check thing I'm very aware of, because in spell check, my name is Michael Feminine. I get that all.
Yeah, autocorrect, that's another peril.
I had to change that.
Oh, boy.
Well, Ben, I know you got to go, and we probably should do some other things, too, but it's great talking with you. The book is How to Not Write Bad.
You got it.
And thanks very much for talking with us. Ben Yagoda.
Thank you very much.